Welcome to episode 16 of The Hard Truth About B2B E-Commerce. I'm your co-host, Isaiah Bollinger of Trellis, and I'm here with Tim. Tim, hi, take everyone. It away.
I'm Timothy Peterson. I'm a client advocate for Trellis and a B2B and B2C e-commerce aficionado. And I'd like to tell you about our sponsor. Our sponsor is PunchOut2Go, and they're a global B2B integration company specializing in connecting commerce business platforms with e-procurement and ERP applications. PunchOut2Go's iPaaS technology seamlessly links business applications to automate the flow of purchasing data. And with their solution, you can immediately reduce integration complexities for PunchOut catalogs, electronic purchase orders, e-invoices, and the like. And once again, thank you to our sponsor. Really appreciate it. And welcome to another episode of The Hard Truth About B2B E-commerce.
I know, it's weird to feel like we're on episode 16 because I feel like we just started this thing. So, it's really exciting to have our guest, Richard Kelly from 1-800-BATTERY, which is also, I guess you would call it part of Market Ring, which is the underlying technology. So you've been in kind of ERP, B2B, e-commerce, you've been in technology kind of most of your career, it sounds like. So tell us a little bit more about how you got into 1-800-BATTERY and Market Ring. What is that? Because I think a lot of people don't, you guys are still fairly new, right? So
sure. So for over 25 years, I've been in enterprise software. I started warehouse management systems, managing inventory and stuff like that for brands that are dead, like Warehouse Entertainment, remember the Warehouse Stores or Andre's, and even Circuit City, and then Doc Martin Shoes, we implemented there, and I went up to Doc Martin for a period of time. And then later I left and created a parcel distribution system. So I created the first Windows multi-carrier, multi-site EDI-enabled pack station with bill of ladings and stuff like that. We were on the forefront of doing a ship station literally 20 years ago. That grew into an ERP software company. Then we supported manufacturers and distributors at a global scale, such as K&N Filters and L'Oreal at Nix and different things like that. So I really started in the back office as far down as telling people what to start on where to pick, how to pick it, how to fulfill it, moved into supply chain of forecasting at a global, allocation at a global, and just continued to move through the operations where I ended up with a large scale ERP system. That ERP system was then installed on a number of distributors for the battery market in the United States. And that got me into the battery market in the early 2000s. We launched a platform and an e-commerce family that at one point, probably 20% of all the batteries that were going online in the United States were going through our funnel. That included integrating configurators into Best Buy and Dell and different things like that. I sold that and exited that business and then got back into the market when I was able to procure the 1-800-BATTERY phone number, which took a long time. That's its own story. It's an incredible story involving Israelis and foreign countries and everything else like that. But I was able to get the access to the 1-800-BATTERY phone number. And then I've been launching this platform on that. And then what our platform does is it takes last mile local providers and delivery people tactics and makes that a commodity so that we can take a brand like any battery, an AC Delco, a Valvoline, a Interstate Batteries, and we can connect the brand to the consumer, interface the dealers, and interface the last mile service providers such as Roadside and everything like that. So we've created a platform that a product can be value added by any person in the chain. So some pretty incredible stuff.
Awesome. Wow. So quite an evolution into e-commerce. And I love that you have the ERP background because I think that a lot of the complexities of B2B e-commerce and why it hasn't really evolved to where it needs to go, I think, is because a lot of people are still kind of stuck in that ERP world. And then they're like, how do I get this into e-commerce? And that whole shift has been, I think, very challenging for a lot of people.
Yeah, for sure.
I suppose one of the things that that comes to mind is, you work with a lot of manufacturers and distributors, right? I mean, so you're at the center of that world, right? So what are you seeing in terms of e-commerce for manufacturers and distributors today?
Yeah, well, like everybody's seen a huge push because of the pandemic and the crisis to a focus on e-commerce. It's not something you can just do overnight or throw up a Shopify site and think that you have e-commerce. That's absolutely, especially B2B. We'll get into that some details later, maybe later. But that push ends up being two strategies right now, and it's a real bad strategy sometimes, is they're either going direct into Amazon. That's their e-commerce. I think that's a very big danger to the brands of not controlling the consumer experience and a consumer availability of brand and just pushing it to Amazon for various predatory reasons. And then, or they go to a D2C, direct to consumer strategy, and that has the potential to create channel conflict and doesn't leverage the existing relationships with their retail and service providers. So they go to D2C in name of quote unquote margin, that hurts them. And if they go to Amazon, that hurts them potentially even more. So I think that they have to have a different strategy, a cohesive, holistic strategy for B2B and B2C when it's all said.
Gotcha. So you feel like there's kind of a missing, you know, they're either going too extreme by going straight to consumer or kind of saying, hey, we're not even going to bother with this in the sense we're just going to ship it all off to Amazon and let them deal with it.
Yep.
And there needs to be kind of more of a middle ground approach of maybe doing, would you say it's more doing a little bit of D2C, some like kind of a combination of these things, or how would you?
I think it depends on the channels and the given products and verticals. So it can be both, but the on the B2B side, they tend to make that a secondary side. I think the B2B support on most distributors and manufacturers is like, the user experience is bad. The implementation is poor. They still have to call and purchase orders. The configuration, we'll talk about that a little bit later, is poor. But so I think the B2B needs to be focused on just as much as the B2C from a distributor manufacturer. And part of that focus on the B2B is also enabling your quote unquote where to buy is not just an address. It's actually a resource that you can leverage. And that's why we built our technology.
Gotcha. I see what you're saying. Cool. So yeah, there's a lot to get into, and I hope people go and check out your guys' site to see what you guys are doing at 1-800-Battery. But let's talk a little bit about the platforms, because I think that ties into what some of these problems are, and I think that's part of the problem is that I think part of the problem is also that the platforms have made it seem easier than it is, and they've commoditized things where they're like, oh, just you know, set up Magento or set up Shopify, set up, you know, there's a lot of platforms out there. I'm just naming some of the popular ones. And people kind of think, oh, you know, just pay an agency, you know, 50 grand or, you know, some modest sum, and then that'll solve their kind of problems. And, you know, can you talk a little bit about why, there's a reason you guys didn't go out and use a Magento or Shopify. You guys, I believe you guys kind of pretty much custom built your whole system. And
we got lucky in the confluence of a certain set of technologies. So we did try. We started that out as, you know, we tried Magento, we tried NopCommerce, we tried Shopify, we tried BigCommerce out of the box, and we broke all of them. So the problem with ours is the categorization requirements and the URL deep linking requirements and the sheer number of locations and product flexibility requirements and fitment and labor, all these different rules. We we could not even get a site to start. Like some loads would take an hour just to boot the site up. So we broke it just on sheer scale of data on our side. So we got lucky headless. And so I'm a big believer in headless, because what that does is it separates the stacks that you can create the user experience that you want and integrate into the given carts that you want. So we can integrate into Shopify. We've had integrations into BigCommerce already, but we're not leveraging their forced delivery system and service and systems. We do it straight headless. So we leverage Amazon Cloud. We leverage other APIification of a whole bunch of things. And that ended up opening a tremendous opportunity for us.
Yeah, I'm a big believer in headless as well. And actually our new website, trellis.co, which still got work and bugs to fix. It's only been out for about a month, is actually Vue.js. It's a headless front end and WordPress back end, but we actually have plans to bring in we have a Magento store that's kind of more of an operational tool, but we're going to bring that in to make it a better user experience for some of the stuff that we might push for more transactional things that we do. And so, yeah, I totally agree. I think headless, actually, I think one of our previous guests, I think it might've been Justin Finnegan, who he ran one of the larger Magento or just e-com agencies. They do a lot more than Magento, but you know, he was saying that what's interesting about headless is that it actually has more applications to B2B in a lot of ways. It has almost more value in a B2B context than it does in B2C, because B2B has so many different systems and potential systems and complexity that it, in some ways it's almost more valuable for B2B. Whereas historically, B2C has been the ones usually adopting these newer technologies, but maybe this might change in the B2B world, hopefully.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, for example, we integrated real-time delivery apps from different providers and stuff like that in a matter of, I don't want to tell anybody how quick it was done because it's really that quick, but by having a segmented system with order dispatch. And so like when our headless comes in, we route it through an order dispatch router based on Amazon SQS, and they will take it and then be able to flick an order here to a retailer via phone, flick one over here via email, flick this one directly integrated into the delivery app, flick this one over here and fire off an EDI purchase order for hub, spoke, and pickup. So by having headless technologies and putting that middleware in the process, you open yourself up to an almost infinite flexibility. And we'll tell you later on one of the other questions I think you pre-sent us on some of the features that we implemented in B2B 20 years ago. So, and they're still trying to catch up. So once they catch up, it's going to be great for businesses. And it just rewards the consumers at the end, right?
Yeah, and we could certainly dive into some of that now. I mean, because you mentioned real-time delivery and, you know, delivery and expectations, right? I mean, I think that that is a wonderful term to use when you're thinking about, you know, e-commerce in general, B2C or B2B, like expectations, right? So,
yeah.
So let's talk a little bit more about, you know, real-time delivery and some of the things that you've, you know, done in there, you know, the details.
Sure. So as you saw that I come from a deep ERP background, and we were solving with automation and optimization and storage and execution and ETAs and allocation, all these different processes to really get to one question is, what do you ship? When do you ship it? And how do you communicate that to your thing? So we can take, for example, we have one of the larger furniture customers in the world using our stuff. We can take an order from them and go, hey, we can't have this for 45 days because we know we've got to move it to Vietnam to the U.S. or part of it's in the U.S. and we need to do the dresser because the bed's missing so it can handle assortments and stuff like that. So by giving the ability to do an ETA to a customer, you reduce your customer service issues and you increase their expectations. So you're basically being honest with them. You're not saying, hey, I can get this to you now. I might be able to get this to you in 45 minutes. From 1-800 battery standpoint, we've done this by kind of like an Uber-like process. We've stepped back from the provider and the location and worked backwards. So we know if there's inventory available or not, or maybe they don't support inventory. So we know their dwell time, what we call a manufacturing term, but we use their lead time of, hey, how long will it take them to get that? So we'll show an ETA to the person during the process before checkout that we can get that battery to you within 90 minutes or 80 minutes or 45 minutes and adjust for traffic in real time, all these crazy things by the benefit of using headless when it's all said and done. So when you give the expectations to the consumer and you're focused on just capturing ETA-like data, you go a long way to improving the processes.
That's a great explanation.
So one of the, that's, I think our listeners are going to really appreciate that because it was a great explanation. It's something that all of us are thinking about. So thank you for actually, you know, putting that out there to the world in such a clear, you know, clear way. But one of the things that you've mentioned Uber a couple times. Can you talk just a little bit more about sort of the driver app and a little bit more about what has happened over there? I'm just curious about it.
Sure. Yeah, I'm going there real quick. The thing about Uber is it's really good about giving you once you booked the order or once you booked the ride, it gives you a lot of interim status. So we did the exact same thing. As we booked the task or the thing, we're letting them know where the driver is without having to download an app. So they can just click a link and we text it to them, SMS. When the driver gets close to do the delivery or install, it texts them, hey, the driver's almost there. And then we obfuscate for people, I've learned obfuscate is not as a common word, but we make it private, the communication that the driver can communicate with the delivery and vice versa, and make that in a private fashion using Twilio and different things like that.
Okay.
Like everybody else does. So that consumer is always being updated, but not over inundated, not spam, not email, whatever it is. We found that SMS is the best format for mobile delivery and install because it has 100% open rate, mm-hmm. or so close to open rate, right? And they're going, oh, good, now somebody's coming to me. So they're not making another call to the call center, hey, where's my driver, whatever, because they can see it themselves. And so we took that into our last mile tactics when we started going down the market.
So, you know, and Isaiah may have a follow-up here, but I want to eventually tie this to the next topic because I already identified like success and failure here, right?
But yeah.
Park that for a second. Isaiah, did you have a...
Yeah, I just wanted to, expand on this. I mean, it does tie into success and failure. And I think that is kind of the crux of what's failing in B2B right now is that B2B, like people buying in general, whether you're a business or a consumer, your expectation is that you're going to get something closer to an Amazon or Uber-like experience, right? We're used to DoorDash or all these things where you can go online, quickly book an appointment, and when you're not getting that experience, it's kind of frustrating. It's not like literally, me and my girlfriend are going through an insurance process and it's so frustrating to get a quote. Like it's been... when talking to the companies, I'm sure there are more automated things we could have used, but sure. When you're talking manually, it's very frustrating that the quoting process has been fairly slow and frustrating. And I think that's what's kind of missing in B2B is that right now things are still stuck in calls or these very old school buying processes and not enough of it has kind of moved into that real time delivery expectation. And I think a lot of that is because it's either stuck in the ERP and then they have to make this massive investment in e-commerce, but then that's disjointed from the ERP. So I'm just kind of curious, kind of circling back to that a little bit, like what for the average company, like what would your advice be? Cause you know, a lot of these, let's use the SMB example, the average, you know, $50 million distributor. That's not, you know, that can't just throw $1 million at their e-commerce site or $2 million. You know, their margins aren't high enough to
you mean other than use our technology and go to market with almost no risk? Okay, we can get into that later. But the...
Maybe they should just talk to you and look at market rank.
You put Trellis on the UI and the front end, the consumer experience, we'll put it all together on a tech and you'll be up and running. In a
so that is one option.
You cannot even imagine. So it's interesting on the question there is it's breaking everything down to its little component. So they silo it into how they conceive the world. And we've been always very different being an enterprise software development company for 20 years and everything else like that, is the same process. We have gateway processes, we like to call them, and it depends on what they are, for allocation, for purchasing, for customer service, for all these different things. And the important is that that's just a point to hook into. So it can be hooked into API, it can be hooked into ERP, it can be hooked into e-commerce. And so for us to do a delivery experience, I don't need e-commerce to do that. That's a separate component. So I can have my e-commerce system, my ERP system, dispatch the order into the same funnel and API system that the e-commerce would to route the order and do the delivery experience. So they can actually step what's important to the business. So some businesses, it's important to do B2B e-commerce. Those businesses are going to be things like large catalog selection, product assortment, so on and so forth, that it's hard for the business-to-business user to book an order or see the visibility or see the marketing or maybe the materials or whatever it is. But there are B2B businesses that they only support 10 products. But that 10 products can be enhanced with delivery technologies. So I would silo each little business benefit into its little component. And that's what headless comes down to. Headless isn't some fancy, it's almost an overly fancy term, but all it is, hey, we're taking this component and it used to be the front end. And then we're saying, we're going to make these other components and then they're all going to start to work together. And that's the benefit of React technologies. You use Vue, we use Next.js.
Yeah, well, we actually do use a lot of React. It's just we chose Vue for our website. But anyways, that's a separate
thing. It doesn't matter. It's JavaScript. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
But by having each thing as a component, you can interface that component to wherever you want. So if it was me, I would look at my own B2B business and say, what is value added to me? Like, for example, my son-in-law owns a trucking company. Their biggest customer is Peloton. We're even talking to that right now. So Peloton does route delivery. They deliver their cycles, stuff like that. So they're only really delivering 3 SKUs or whatever. But yeah. They have the same problem of delivery at scale and the broken apps that they use a couple of one. I won't name them because they're bad experiences for the operators. It's harder for them, which should be easy for the operator. You make it easy for the operator. That's another key on the technology. You make it easier on the operators and the data entry people and the customer service people. They'll use your tool, which is why SAP and ERP systems are so difficult to use in those aspects. And they push them through those funnels. Because the operator experience is so hard. So when you focus your strategy on the tech, you have to think about 3 things. You have to think about your customer's position. You have to think about the external operator's position and then your own internal operators. And if you componentize that and go, I'm making an experience cohesive for all 3 layers, you'll get 100% adoption of your technology. It'll be so easy. They'll forget they never had it. And that's when technology is successful in any business.
Yeah. And so to kind of summarize, you know, for the companies that may be on a limited budget, it's like you said, it's distilling that down and looking at the problem. So, you know, if you have 1 million SKUs, it's very different than the problem of I'm Peloton, I have 3 SKUs and it's more of an operation logistics problem. Yep. And then maybe focus in the areas that you can kind of afford to chip away at. And I think that's part of the other problem is that people, they kind of maybe trying to do everything as an all-in-one and they could go in more of an agile format, maybe start with, you know, product data, if it's a large catalog, get that solved. So at least you can see the products well and then maybe chip away at the delivery component or start to kind of solve these problems iteratively.
It's baby steps. It's baby steps.
Well, you know, you hit on something here that has come up in most, if not all of our episodes, is that, you know, the way that Isaiah just put this about the all-in-one, you know, the all-in-one is a fantasy for most businesses that I know of, whether they're B2B or B2C or a combo, it really is a fantasy. You have to just have that straight line, you know, or there's nothing really that disrupts that straight line in order for that, you know, to work. You know, so it is the baby steps. I mean, to pick up on what you just said, it's just saying, okay, what's next? What's next? What's next? You know, and like getting more of that stuff done and getting more successes as you do it.
Yeah. And it's amazing how that works. And I've had 0 failures in ERP implementations in 25 years. And I think I'm the only ERP software company that can say that.
Can we like put that quote somewhere? That's like zero failures.
Zero.
I like that.
And we've had tremendous benefits. Like we've taken manufacturers that had 30-day plus lead times down to their lead time being a day. And that's just about optimizing the components. And they started with parcel distribution, and then they moved into inventory control. So there are strategies that you can use for ERP implementations. One of the big issues on that, especially as a consulting firm, we've both been in the service side of consulting, is that the management either doesn't have true buy-in from the C-level, and more importantly, is you end up with all this consulting and all this work and all this needs analysis and stuff like that. I always think that's overdone and oversold and waste a lot of capital that could be used on good solutions. As you componentize and break down, hey, we're going to get to this milestone, and this milestone is going to be implemented. It's not going to be on the to-do list, because if you don't implement that now, then you can't do step 2. So one of the big things that Isaiah just said was product data. Most small businesses, and even big businesses, they might be worse, are terrible at their product data. That is the lifeblood of the internet, is the lifeblood of your business. You have to take that seriously. It has to be its own department that has a hub and spoke that I deal with product data, and I deal with marketing data, and I deal with pricing data, and I deal with inventory data. That if you put product data culturally as the forefront of your business to start with, you all the other things you want to do from B2B to B2C to ERP to all that stuff, they all become much easier. So make sure that product data isn't entering your stuff in a spreadsheet or having things. So product information management is probably the single biggest barrier to success when you start the process. And then there's other barriers later, but that's the biggest one from my perspective.
I agree.
Well, yeah, because it's so core, a lot of my work is marketing work in addition to, you know, the other aspects of what I've done over the years. And I have to say product is at the core of everything. And I've often gone to businesses and say, okay, we need to go back to that step. How are we defining this product? What are all the attributes of the product? Where is all the data on the attributes of the product? Why is there only one image of the product? right? It's something you have to go back to haven't done. Right?
So bad. Yeah. I just did a manufacturer 2 years ago that you would know publicly. They're a household name for automotive part in the aftermarket. Like you see their sticker on every car in every event, right? They didn't have their own data of what fit their own vehicles in a digital format. So we were able to go and get that data for them during part of the implementation by using the internet, scraping the data, and then going through a whole process, and even actually using a little AI training bots, but go and say, hey, we've reassembled your product data in a digital format. So when you think that you can print a catalog and that printed catalog becomes your Bible, again, they were started in 1920, so that might be part of the cultural reason, but you're late to the game, and that's really important. Nuanced, but I guess we got next questions, I'm sure.
Yeah. We're doing good though.
We're doing great. This is all right.
So we kind of tied into the B2C stuff, but Tim, I think
let me kind of weave some of these things, you know, because we're covering a lot of great ground here, and that's really what our listeners are here for and our viewers are here for. They want to meet great people like you who have a lot of success, right? And really have your finger in a lot of different, you know, a lot of different places. You've been there, you've done that, and you're offering them, you know, a lot of great tips here really on how to view things, right? So for me, I always go, I love going to two different, you know, kind of sides of a coin. It's like, you know, success and failure, which we've been talking a lot about, but really B2B and B2C. And, you know, it traditionally, I would say, or in the last however many years, I would say that the most innovation was coming B2C to B2B. That may be changing, or a lot of things are originating in B2B today. But you know, what do you see about this? So like, what angle do you come from? Do you see a lot of innovation still happening in B2C that B2B hasn't quite pulled from yet? Or what do you think?
No, actually, since we were ERP and back office, we had B2B functionality. I'll give you some examples of what we did almost 20 years ago. Is the B2B has to have more business rules flexibility because they're handling more spots in the chain. Everything from we were doing blind drop shipping and of 20 years ago, a third party freight billing, packing slip customization, product private labeling on demand. We've supported that for a long time. Contract pricing, multiple price levels, multi warehouse support, allocation and ETAs, which we talked about earlier, which I'm a big believer is allocation ETA. If you have a true allocation ETA system, not a min-max or not something that you're literally saying this order will get this product, you can go a long way to improving your ETA and operations. Multiple users on an account, SKU lookup by your SKU, not the B2B SKU. So you're just putting in your own catalog. You're not having to think about it. Order import versus APIs or spreadsheet import. There's a bunch of different ways to do that. There's so many different details and things that need to be done in B2B that we did 20 years ago, just because that's what it was required to get people to adopt our systems for those channels that we implemented B2B in. So that has to be more and more commoditized and more thought about as all these little business rules. Because what you ever see in any type of enterprise technology is there's going to be an internal resistance. So the internal resistance is going to be, well, what about this? And what about that? And what about this? And what about that? And you go, those little check boxes that the blockers have in the thing is usually because they're responsible for that internally and they don't want to lose control. And losing control is not losing control. It's managing by exception instead of managing everything. Mm-hmm. So when we implement ERP, we implement B2C, we implement every doesn't matter what we implement, is we're always looking and say we want 90% of everything to just flow through. And then the 10% really does require human interaction, and every business is always going to have that. Even if it's 20, it's a Pareto rule. If it's 80-20, is spend your time on the 20% that causes issues. Don't make 100% of orders or issues. So by having all those little check boxes and adding your B2B flexibility, both ERP, external APIs, whatever it happens to be, you reduce that 100% down to 80%, down to 90%, so that you're only managing the exceptions. You can scale a business. I'll give you an idea of one of the companies we did. When we started, they were $16 million. They had 400 employees. They were barely making payroll. When we left, they were $250 million and sold to Goldman Sachs. And the reason that happens is, and they had the same number of employees.
Hmm. Okay, that's interesting. That's wow. Good. Wow. That doesn't happen often.
It doesn't, but it does happen if you apply technologies and baby steps and all those little connecting dots. So you can grow to as big as you possibly can imagine in your market. And technology was the 80% driver of, they had a great brand that was sitting dead forever. Doc Martin had the same issue when we went there. They had issues when we started, but the is by doing those little things, you create a better operation and you can scale because you're only managing the exceptions. You're not managing everything.
So is it fair to say, and the way I look at it is that B2B, to your point, in a lot of ways, they've been ahead and they still have very sophisticated kind of like potential, not, it depends on the organization. They've got these, sophisticated ERPs and, operational processes. But the problem is that's not visible to the customer. So going back to the concept of headless. Yeah. So it's like, I think to Tim's point is like, it's B2C. Really what the problem is that, B2B in some ways is more advanced than B2C, but it's all behind the scenes. So you don't actually know what's happening. Like you don't know how they're making the order. When you buy, your desk or whatever, like you said, you don't know that it's going to Vietnam and then all these places and all this craziness.
Absolutely.
So really what the problem is that there's that user experience ETA layer that's kind of missing from B2B that B2C has kind of started to master but they might be lacking some of the operational components that B2B has.
Right. For sure.
Is that kind of I'm just trying to kind of sum it up.
That's a very good summary of what I'm doing. And that actually kind of leads probably to the last part of that is why the disconnect. And it's usually because they've siloed the teams. I'm a big flat hierarchy person. So that they should all be doing, you might be the expert in this subject, but somebody's the expert on that subject. They all need to cohesively be working together to make everybody's life easier. And so the e-commerce team is stuck under marketing and they're away from manufacturing and distribution.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Distribution people are stuck in that. The CIO is responsible for back office and the CTO is responsible for architecture. Like it's all over the place. And what they need to basically come down and say is, how do we make sure this all fits together like a puzzle? Because it is a complex puzzle. So if those rules are in the ERP system and they're handling those things, if you're handling it over the phone, you can codify it one way or another. If you don't have the tech, you can build the tech or buy the tech. If you have it in the tech and it's stuck in there, and it's not in the B2B, you need to expose that because all business problems come down to two problems, only two, communication and information. So if you solve the communication problem, which B2B is nothing but a communication tool, you solve the information problem, you've gone a long way of making your life easier and making your customers' life easier and your internal people's lives easier.
Gotcha. Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. And one of the reasons I love e-commerce is because I truly believe like if you're doing it right, it's kind of the intersection of all departments, right? So if you have a good e-commerce department, they should be talking to operations and fulfillment and then talking to sales. And that's where I think is to your point where it fails is that what happens is e-commerce, gets lumped under IT or gets lumped under marketing or gets lumped under one department. And then they're just, they only care about that little thing that the department cares about. And then it doesn't really become very successful because it needs operations. It needs customer success and customer service. And it needs everything, right? Like it is, it's your business.
I mean, one thing I would say too, Rich, is that you seem like so on target in the way that you've like crystallized a lot of these things that, we've been talking about and we're all challenged by and working on and see the successes of. I really love your approach and the way you boil it down. Do you have a series of ebooks or anything?
No, but you know what? I should write a book.
Yeah, I really think, and I don't say this to many people,
I should.
But you've got it like compartmentalized in a really good way. And you've got the cred and that history, right? All of these decades that you've seen it all. I really, really like, the way you put a lot of this information out to our listeners. They're going to appreciate it. You should do more of it. That's what I say.
Thank you. I got very lucky. I dropped out of college and went to the warehouse management software company at 18 and a half years old. Mm-hmm. So I've never done anything different. So I've been focused on, billions of dollars in business. I grew up in it. I didn't know any different. And by having access to the data pre-internet, like, you know, where you could write the database queries before there was even really, I think we're in Oracle version 2 at one point. But the it just gives you a different perspective, because as that data is funneling through, it gave me a wide lens of how do I, A, control the data, because as you get more and more data, the more and more opportunity you have. And that's how I built the application businesses. But it was really just, you know, whatever higher power in the universe that you believe, they basically, I was going to med school is what my plan was, is they literally took me out of that and said, here is this thing, and self-learned, self-taught, self-exposed. And it was just luck. And it came down to common sense and asking the question, why, and then how. So every time it's like, well, it works this way. And I go, well, why? That doesn't make any sense. We can do it. There's a metal in different ways. What do you think it is? And so I've had hundreds, if not thousands of people give me their input on how they saw the problem, what that problem was. And then I'd have to boil that down and break it down to a component so that I could have a developer work on it as well. So bridging the technology, bridging the business, bridging the user, and bridging the data, all those things came together. And I started at such a young age that it helped crystallize all that stuff over decades once all said and done.
Wow. Yeah, that's pretty impressive. And speaking of all that knowledge, you know, I want to just get to, you know, we're actually getting through everything, which I'm impressed that we were able to get through it. That's a testament to your concise, but
yeah, I gotta
full
say.
Answers. Is going back to kind of the B2B complexity, for a lot of people, I think in B2B, they overcomplicate it. And then so I see two problems. I think sometimes they either overcomplicate it or they assume it's too similar to B2C, because there are differences, right? And you talked in the ERP side, you talked about that with like company accounts. Corporate accounts is like one of the most common things in B2B e-commerce that most people aren't using. Like most companies we talk to aren't properly using corporate accounts for B2B e-commerce. So I'm just curious to hear what you think some of the key things specific to B2B that you would do if you were an e-com, like, you know, I just want to keep it a little bit simpler, and let's pretend they don't have your amazing technology. And let's just say they had to build just kind of a more basic B2B site with, you know, 10,000 SKUs, something kind of in the middle of the road, kind of there with a B2B experience. What are some of the features that are different? Not just buy an add to cart and you get your list price, because we all know that's probably not.
It cannot be list price. Well, that's the first one I would do is the customer. Well, two things I would do if I was on the B2B to make them feel as part of the process. First, it all goes back to culture, is you have to have C-level buy-in and understand that it has to work. Like, culture is a big differentiator for success in all these aspects. So get the cultural stuff down, get the open honesty in the team, and then move forward. So that's the first thing, like, because you're going to make hard decisions, and hard decisions require honesty. The first thing I would do on the B2B stuff is I would focus on the corporate accounts. I would make that their ship tos are integrated automatically. They're a multi-ship to thing. I would make sure that their pricing, because pricing could be complex. It could be geolocated pricing, facility pricing, contract pricing, timed pricing. For this month, it's a campaign that it's $50 off, whatever it happens to be. I would make sure that your pricing into your B2B is 100% of the time the pricing that you're going to give that to your customer. Because if you just show a list price, it just becomes...
Oh, yeah. You don't have to sell me on that, but I totally...
So pricing is number one. So if you're communicating to... And then the final part of that would be letting the customer edit their own ship dues and get them into that buy-in that they own that data a little bit, right?
Yeah.
But and make sure that they can put in their own SKU, so that their own SKU plus their own pricing makes them feel like they're part of the process, because they're not having to look it up. They're not having to do any goofy thing. They can put in their part number might be VAB1234, and your internal SKU is 03-2630 because you've got different systems. Go ahead and make sure that you do for your B2B customer what you want done for you. So it's a simple mantra. You know, it goes back to biblical things. Do to others as you would do unto yourself. So make sure that your execution is what you would want them to do for you. So if you put yourself in their shoes and go, boy, I would really like that to work that way. Do it without excuse, without delay, and without nonsense. That's what you have to do. And I think that goes a long way to changing the mindset culturally, operationally, and executionally.
I totally agree with that. But one of the things that I think is sometimes a hindrance to this is partly the lack of headless, because if you have to integrate ERP, like one problem we see is if you have two pricing, let's say you have pricing in your ERP and then you have pricing in the e-com platform, the e-com platform is going to display the pricing, right? So there's a few ways you can do this. We've actually had it automatically display the ERP pricing using mm-hmm. APIs. So it just automatically pulls in. That's the way. But the problem is some people's ERPs are so old and the APIs are so bad, they can't do a real-time lookup on their API, on their price API. So
yep. Other than calling us to use our technology, we're always going to pass that one, is that pricing doesn't change that often. So what you have to do then is build an extract import and then extract import it into a public cloud database and gotcha. Whatever it is. And
extract then build the data.
Yep. So you could do that. Like literally that project sounds like complex to everybody that's going, wow, our pricing's stuck or our ERP is so slow, we can't do that. You don't have to real-time call the ERP. You build a gateway. And that project that you just said there is measured in days or hours, to be honest with you. So you can extract data 100 different ways. You can schedule that and you can build that price engine in a shorter time than
upgrading the ERP, right? Because
don't upgrade the ERP until you really need to. That's another time. And as an ERP guy, right?
it's amazing. You gave that biblical reference about do unto others, but it's so clear and so direct. Again, I just give you a lot of kudos for this because again, it's there is something about how people overcomplicate or the challenges that are real that they get so mired in and confused in. And I love how you just cut right to the chase. I can, I can hear the angels singing in the background.
I actually live next door. I live on the ocean here, and next door is the biggest church in our area.
So that's why I hear
Kobe Bryant got married there. So that's how crazy it is. And I live right there. Wow. So I can hear them praying on Sunday, literally.
Wow. I love the honesty, though. I think that's what we need more of that in technology and in the work that we're doing is I think people, especially what's happening in B2B, you know, just to digress a little bit, it's just, I think a lot of these, companies are kind of, you know, they don't want to admit it, but they're scared because Amazon's coming and taking all their business and they don't know what to do. And I think we need, that's why we started this podcast. It's like, we're just trying to get you the honest, unbiased, like, you know, Trellis does certain services, but I'm not trying to sell anyone, you know, our platforms. We're just trying to give them the honest answers the best that we can.
Is it the hard truth that you're looking for, Isaiah? Is that it? The hard truth about B2B e-commerce.
Right. The hard truth. Yeah. And it always goes down to culture though, right? So it's important to break those silos down and get management and ownership to go, boy, it should just work that way, right? So I think that's what set my whole career apart from day one. And early on, I was like, I wanted to get fired. I wanted to go back to college. I didn't want to be working 15 hours a day and having all this responsibility and everything else like that. So I kept on challenging the narrative. Why shouldn't it work that way? Isn't that just common sense? Like it should just be automatic on this thing because we have all this computing power, which I thought was amazing back then, which literally the iPhone has a 10,000 times X more power today. So the ability to do it today is easier than when I started 25 years ago. So the there is no excuse. There is no pricing, whatever it happens to be. There is no excuse not to do it today, not to do baby steps. You don't have to go crazy and implement SAP. You don't have to go crazy and do whatever it is. But you can take a baby step and just baby step it along the way.
And that's
all it takes. Incremental improvements. Every day you're doing something different.
I agree with you. I think that that's a cultural issue. I think that part of what we also want to achieve with this podcast is change the culture in e-commerce and especially B2B e-commerce, because we think there needs to be that cultural shift, because the ability is there. It's a cultural issue, I think.
Tech people tend to over-tech and complicate things. Mm-hmm. Some people tend to oversimplify it. Some people tend to just be drama and they're just negative and pessimistic by nature. My nature is very positive. I think the world is better now than it was 20 years ago. I think it's going to be better 20 years from now for my grandkids and everything else like that than it is today. And it's interesting when we talk about Amazon and how their thing, Amazon has some glaring weaknesses that we won't go into now, but they don't even know they have them. And the pendulum of life is always swinging. So you have to make sure that you're always thinking ahead on those little things culturally, thinking about those little things ahead business-wise, and how as things become componentized and easier and easier and easier, it's easier to stitch together competitors. I'll give you an idea. I believe 1-800-BATTERY is going to be the biggest battery company in the United States in the next 5 years. We don't need, because we have a different mindset. We're not taking 20 years to build out supply chains. We're not taking doing anything. We're just taking smart strategies and smart things and connecting it all together in real time at scale. And that can be done in so many different industries, and it can be done for the brands themselves. We have a slide in our deck that says, you can be the own marketplace for your own products so that you can control that thing. If you farm that out to Amazon or you farm that out to a thing, you lose that experience of the brand equity that you've built. So by taking a different mindset and going, we want to put ourselves out there and we want to take these little baby steps. That's all it takes to start a company. That's all it takes to build a B2B site. All it takes is just the guts to move forward and the self-honesty to get to the devil in the details.
Yeah, no, that's very true. Well, I know, Tim, we both got stops coming up. So
that's a good ending, right?
Yeah, no,
that was great.
Yeah,
that was absolutely perfect. Really,
the Rich Keller sermon from the church.
Yeah, I love this stuff, and I think this is amazing. I think it's important to have that optimistic, positive view instead of we're all gonna, work for Amazon one day. Like you said, a lot of these companies have weaknesses. And a lot of times, the bigger they get, the more weaknesses they have, because
the backlash is coming and people are believing in some. I'm a big believer in local sustainability, local economies, creating value add for your fellow man in your own community. I'm very altruistic. And I think that Amazon's predatory tactics and just being doing what they're doing is going to hurt their brand. It already has with. They decide what's essential goods. They Prime all of a sudden didn't work anymore, even though you paid for it, right? It just all of a sudden no longer 2-day delivery during the supply chain resiliency breakdown. Their supply chain didn't break down. It's just important to know that people like people. And when they like people, they like their neighbors. And they like their neighbors, they like the local store they buy from. And by enabling that from the B2B guys to their retailers at scale, and as well as taking that as a mantra going forward, you create a better America, create a better city, and it all starts with just your little nexus. And that's my final sermon.
We got to give you your publishers because you're ready. I want to read those books. I want to see them.
You help me ghostwrite it.
We'll do it.
So we kind of got into that last thought on what is this coming decade for B2B e-commerce. And I think the timing of this is great. 2020, right? I think 2010 to 2020 was kind of like the B2C, revolution. And now you saw with COVID, it's into like the 30-40% online B2C. But I think B2B, we're kind of in that. We're in the earlier stage of that evolution. So I'm just kind of curious, what do you see?
I see things getting easier, and I always believe in the power of Moore's law. As everybody knows, computing power. I also have I have some laws in myself. Keller's law is the data keeps getting available, so that whatever it happens to be real time, everything else like that. I think the next interface will not be web; it will be voice. That you'll go, I need XYZ to the thing, and the phone will and automatically take care of all of the interfaces that we're talking about. Cut the order at the right price, send the driver with delivery and everything else like that. And we're building our entire technology stack just from internal search technologies and internal voice technology. We're building our entire stack to see that long-term vision that everything will just be, hey, just like Star Trek. Star Trek is so far ahead. You go, computer, I need this. It's all done for you, right? That is where we head. AI allows that for conversational. All the little glue technologies are coming into place. That our grandkids might not even need a web browser because they can just say it, it'll happen.
Yeah, and it's funny because That might be the most advanced answer we've heard yet. I think me and Tim are like,
well, everybody talks about nonsense and almost this big picture fluffy thing. You got to get dirty. You got to do the hard work. And that's my personal belief.
That's awesome. So there you heard it, everyone. build the infrastructure so that one day when
you won't need it.
But that when people ask for your thing, you come up with. I think Gary Vee talks about that. He's like, when someone asks for soap or whatever, you know, you want to be the one that comes up, right, on Alexa.
Oh, it'll be smarter than that. It'll know what soap you like based on your skin type and your age. Like, it'll be so smart that it'll just go, wow, that was easy. I got the soap that's for me because this soap dries my skin and this soap doesn't. So when you're thinking about the devil and the details at scale and not generic, it will allow you to be ahead of the game.
Wow. Well, I think everyone's mind is blown right now. So we can do that.
That's amazing.
So call us, Dove. We'll help you.
Well, thank you so much. This is awesome. So for everyone that wants to get in touch with you, I believe it's 1-800-BATTERY.
What's the best way to get in touch? Just email me. I'm on LinkedIn. I actually prefer business to business contacts on LinkedIn. I love LinkedIn as a platform. I know some people don't. I do. I like it as my business platform. It integrates into my CRM. So like that makes it just easier on me. But it's richard@1800battery.com and with no hyphens, just richard1800battery.com. And again, LinkedIn, it's Richard Keller, and you can LinkedIn search me and just add me. I'm an open book. I do angel investing. I also do mentoring of startups. Wow. I believe my localization is also about giving back. Is saying, hey, here's my experience. And if I had somebody in my life that had my experience 25 years ago, I would have dodged a lot of bullets that I took into the shoulder. So that I'm an open book. It's a very simple thing. And then
that's awesome.
Reach out. And I don't care if you're a college student that has an idea, or if you're the CEO of Tesla. I want to talk to him. I've owned 5 Teslas. He needs to call me. Elon, listen to this podcast. I want my call.
If we can get in listening to this podcast, I think we'll get some more, yes. more viewers.
Yes. Yes.
Well, I want to thank you once again. And I'm going to have to sign off
because I'm done too.
Coming up right now. But this has been such a pleasure. We got to get you on again.
Yeah. This is awesome. Richard, I'm going to send you an email and we'll be in touch.
Great. Thanks, guys.
It's a pleasure.